Welcome to New Books in Journalism, where we talk about the latest works in journalism, media, and communication with the people who wrote them. I'm David Schwartz from the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Our guests for this episode are Ethan Thompson and Jason Mattel, editors of the new book, How to Watch Television, a collection of essays from today's leading scholars on television culture. Jason, Ethan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So before we get to how to watch television, first, just give us a little bit about your background. Ethan, let's start with you. Just give us your academic and your professional background, and then we'll move on to you, Jason.
Okay, my name is Ethan Thompson. I'm an associate professor at Texas A&M University, Corpus Christi. And the way I got into this field, actually, is that I grew up in a very small town, just about 20 miles from here, and television was kind of my route out and away from places, and gave me access to different ways of thinking and different things to experience in the world. I ended up going to the University of Texas as an undergrad, and then I got my PhD at the University of Southern California in cinema, television, critical studies.
And Jason, go ahead.
So I'm a professor of film and media culture and American studies at Middlebury College in Vermont. And I started as, you know, I went to Oberlin College as an undergrad, and I was a theater and English double major. And I knew I was always interested in popular culture, but there was no course of study at that time at Oberlin. And by sheer luck and happenstance, I was living in Minneapolis after undergraduate, and I took a class at the University of Minnesota that was taught by a visiting professor who I knew nothing about, by the name of John Fisk. And taking that class with him, I slowly learned, oh, wait a minute, he is pretty much the founder or one of the founders of a certain type of television studies in the U.S. And it really inspired me. And I went on and followed him to University of Wisconsin-Madison and got my PhD there. And pretty much focused on television, but also film and other forms of popular culture. And I've been at Middlebury since 2002.
So now Fisk, I believe, also was, the mentor to Jenkins, and you have Jenkins as a chapter in this book. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And actually, you know, if you look at the book, there are a lot of people who came from Wisconsin as grad students, as well as USC. So there's certainly a network of affiliated faculty and grad students that are represented in the book.
So now, Ethan, you were Texas and USC, and Jason, you were, you said Oberlin and Wisconsin. So how did you two begin collaborating? Was this book the first time, or had you collaborated before?
Well, I guess we've just run in the same circles in television studies going back a number of years. Actually, the first presentation I ever did at a conference, I was on a panel with Jason and Henry Jenkins, as a matter of fact, about parody. And my work focuses more on television and comedy. So that was like the first time that we had met. And then I guess from there, we tend to go to the same conferences and have a lot of the same, friends and colleagues that we called upon to contribute to this book.
And
sorry,
yeah,
go ahead, Jason.
I had not done any formal collaboration. And I just want to make it clear for the world to know that the book was originally Ethan's idea, and he came to me with the pitch and asking me to contribute an essay. And it was still pretty early. I was one of the first people he approached, and I loved the idea so much that I actually asked him, would you be interested in working with a co-editor on this? So it was his conception, and I jumped on.
Yeah, and I seized that opportunity because it meant half the work and twice the quality. As far as I was concerned, it really allowed the book to become something much bigger in terms of its scope, and so that was it. Just was kind of a no-brainer for me to get Jason involved as well.
Great. So at its genesis, before Jason got involved, and you had this idea, where did it come from? What prompted you to think that, okay, this is a book that needs to be produced?
Well, I tell you what, it goes back to the very first time I ever found myself in a classroom trying to teach television criticism and television studies to students, there's really this kind of this void in critical writing between the kind of like short or content-based like reviews of television that people might see, formerly in a newspaper and now online, I guess. And then the kind of academic criticism that scholars, are producing. So in other words, there's just this void of the kind of things that we often want our students to produce, which in a classroom tends to focus on a particular TV series or one central issue. Whereas television scholarship, more formal scholarship, usually is larger in scope and also written for a different audience in mind. So the need for something like this, was quite apparent, but how to go about it, who to involve, and what the real focus of it would be, took a lot more time to kind of work itself out.
And kind of go through that process. The book, for listeners, there are 40 essays in the book, and they each focus mostly on a show.
The idea, I would say that kind of the way that we got people on board was to tell them, like, this is what we want this book, to be for. And what we'd really like is for you to write an essay about a TV show that you would like to write about. but kind of narrow it down, allow people to just focus on one show and even a particular episode of a show, perhaps one that they use to teach in the classroom that they find useful. And Jason and I, discussed amongst ourselves, well, how do we go about getting the proper critical scope? How do we cover the variety of different critical methods and approaches, as well as different genres and types of shows that we want, by contacting and involving different people in this project? The amazing thing was that really, without exception, everyone we asked to potentially contribute to the book agreed to do so, and we even found the book on growing in scope because we had such a positive response.
And that's great. Yeah. And I'm sorry, Jason, go ahead.
Yeah, we didn't start this process collaborating where Ethan, when he approached me and said, we want to write a book with 40 essays. And I would say anyone who is listening who's thinking about editing their own anthology, don't try to edit a book with 40 essays. It's
or 40
kind of a kamikaze move. But one of the challenges of teaching television is that the object of study is almost infinite in scope. We have, over 60 years of history. We have, thousands and thousands of different programs that have aired during that time. Across many, many different nations with very little interplay, between national television systems for the most part. And a huge range of genres, both fictional and non-fictional. And you can cover so much material in a television studies course, especially an intro class, which is what we conceived this for, that we realized that simply to put together a book that we felt hit on so many different areas that a faculty member might want to cover, that we needed a large number of essays just to cover it. We did not want to have essays focused on a genre or an era. We wanted to focus on an individual show because, like Ethan said, we were trying to provide models for student writing. And we don't, typically in the assignment that I usually give as the final essay for my intro to television class is choose a television program and analyze it using one of the concepts we've explored. I give more parameters there. We don't ask, write a history of the sitcom, so we really want something very focused. And I think that those types of models are rare and hard to find, especially that seem researchable and writable in a tone that undergrads are able to do.
Now, Ethan, I want to come back to your particular article and chapter in just a bit, but Jason, sticking with yours, to give the listeners an idea of one type of article, of chapter that they'll find in this book, you wrote about the children's show Phineas and Ferb. And yes. You kind of turned on its head this idea that children's TV is always mindless programming. It's always commercialized. Take just, if you would, a couple minutes to a few minutes to talk about your chapter and what it is that you were trying to do with it.
Sure. So, like I said, one of the main purposes of the book was to cover the scope of what, you know, television studies course might cover. And children's television is a really important part of TV history and a really important part of the function of the medium. And there's a much more limited body of research, especially from a humanistic critical perspective. There's a fair amount of social science about educational television and media effects, but very little criticism. So we wanted to definitely include a chapter on children's television. And the chapter, I think, is a good example of the approach of the book as a whole, where we asked authors to take something that either they have written about in another format and to distill it for a sort of undergraduate criticism audience, or to take some of their thrust of what they write about methodologically, topically, or, you know, a certain genre or what have you, and apply it to a new object of study. And the latter is what I did. So I've written a fair amount about children's television and animation. And one of the things that I've written about is the way in which children's television has functioned as a bad object throughout the medium's history. It's very easy to blame television for various social ills, usually tied to children's culture. And I think that's shifted somewhat in the past 10 years with the rise of video games as the new bad object, or the internet, social networking, what have you. But still, I think children's television, when you talk to most everyday people, they see children's television as a problem, not a strength of the medium. So I wanted to combat that and really think about children's television, which I see right now is really thriving and having so many great programs. I have three children, so I get to watch a lot of these programs once removed through the eyes of my kids. And when we were putting together the project, Phineas and Ferb was my kid's favorite show. It's still my son's favorite show. And I watched a number of the episodes and was really impressed with the clever plotting and sophistication of the way in which the show worked. At the same time, my major research project is a book on television narrative that I call Complex Television. It looks at the concept of narrative complexity in recent serialized TV. And as I was watching Phineas and Ferb with my kids, I realized that many of the hallmarks of narrative complexity were being transferred to children's television in this show, which I thought was fascinating. So the bulk of my essay is arguing that, unlike the characterization, children's television can speak up to viewers instead of speaking down to them and encourage them to engage in a mode of viewing that forces them to pay close attention. It's not about distraction, but rather attention. It forces them to think about narrative structure in a way that we don't tend to think that kids do when they're watching TV, although I argue they would, and that the humor is built on, in some ways, the repetition of the form. A lot of people complain that television, especially children's television, is overly formulaic. And what I think is fascinating about Phineas and Ferb is they use the formulaic structure as a strength, not a weakness, because it's all about the variations on the form. So there's a lot of things that happen in every single episode of Phineas and Ferb in terms of plot and character moves and recurring jokes and lines and everything. And the way in which they use that formulaic structure is to create moments of pleasure and humor through slight variations on those formulas or anticipation of how the formula will deliver. So the essay is exploring one episode and how that plot structure actually gets repeated in multiple episodes across a few seasons and tries to ultimately argue that there's a level of sophistication that is there that's not just sort of doublespeak for adults to enjoy, but actually is why kids really love the show.
So Ethan, I'm sorry, Phineas and Ferb is a fairly current show. There's a chapter in there that focuses on parks and recreation. This is still for the most part, is still on the air. There are also chapters on Dick Van Dyke and The Cosby Show. How did you – was this a conscious decision? I know you sort of let people pitch what they wanted to do, but did you want to have a mix of the classical show or the older shows and also what is current?
Yeah, absolutely. That was one of the things that we wanted to do, was provide that kind of historical scope. And I don't know, perhaps ironically, I'm probably the person that selected the TV show that was instantly the most dated, because mine only ran for one season. It's now gone by the time the book was published. But certainly we were attempting to kind of provide that scope, as well as, you know, show that you can apply these critical approaches to programs, whether they were on the air, you know, 50 years ago, 30 years ago, or today. So there definitely was that kind of attempt. I also, as a matter of fact, I wanted to add, you know, that I'm currently in the process right now. I'm teaching television criticism, two television criticism courses. And we actually just used Jason's essay on Phineas and Ferb last week to talk about narrative complexity. And, you know, doing that, despite the fact that my students, I don't need to assign them Phineas and Ferb to watch. Many of them have exposure to that already. But we're able to use that essay to talk about narrative complexity and all different kinds of television series. So my students read his essay. We discussed his essay as a way to think about how television formula and narrative works, the notion of repetition with variation. So they're then applying that in their own analyses of all sorts of different television programs.
Sure. And the chapter was fascinating. I mean, Jason, like you, I have three kids, and I tend to shy away when they start wanting to watch things that are on Disney. But they did, you know, stumble upon Phineas and Ferb one day, and it was incredibly complex. And you're right. It was not what, you know, you would think as being a stereotypical, you know, kid show.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things I try to get at in the essay, and just in general when writing about kids' TV, is trying to see it from the kids' point of view, mm-hmm. to some degree, but using adult critical tools, and, you know, academic tools. And I think that, you know, Ethan, it's great to hear that the students got that from their own experience and were able to reflect on that. But I think that one of the challenges of teaching popular culture and specifically TV is getting students to think critically about their own experiences. In our selection of which shows we wanted covered, we definitely wanted a range of shows in terms of history and genre and things like that. But we also wanted to make sure that there were some shows that would be things that the students were already very familiar with and had a attachment to, so that when they read the criticism, they could see that criticism isn't just about sort of critiquing or complaining about something, but rather that there's a way that the sort of affection for an object can come through as well through close analysis.
And Jason was talking about, you know, the Phineas and Ferb is something, you know, that people can identify with. There's some characters there. You joked about how the show you looked at, Onion News Network, lasted for a season. You know, it was basically one and done. But I thought that your essay wasn't so much about the show itself as it was about the whole idea of, was it audience taste and brand identity and the era of the DVR. Talk about your piece a little bit more in terms of brand identity and the DVR and these new technologies, and how it applied to the show that you considered.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank goodness for all of us, The Onion continues, right? The Onion carries on in its many different forms. And you're right, my piece is looking at it's The Onion News Network ostensibly, but really the topic of my piece is the idea of brand identity and the concept of flow, which is really central to television studies. And trying to determine, you know, what is television criticism about anyway? What is the television in television criticism? And the concept of flow is essentially that, you know, we have to think about our experience of television not being just these kind of finite blocks of time that you used to see when you look at the television schedule of, you know, this show on for 30 minutes. Rather, it's the various different pieces that come together that we experience in television. And nowadays, because we can experience TV in so many different ways on our own, and in terms of when we watch things, how we watch them, what devices we're watching them on, it's even more important for the channels that are programming TV to have a sense of consistency across those various segments, so that there's a clear brand and the audience for those shows recognizes that it is appealing to their taste, however different those segments might seem. So my essay is looking at the Onion News Network and the way in which the Independent Film Channel, which programmed the Onion News Network, branded not just that show, but the commercials during that show, whether they be for Acura, which was integrated into the program itself with a panel of commentators, or even the promotions for the sitcom Malcolm in the Middle, which was then airing on IFC and needed to be rebranded and made consistent with the IFC kind of hipster brand image that they worked to cultivate. So doing that, I look at a single episode of the Onion News Network, which was about an asteroid headed to Earth and going to destroy the planet by the time the episode was over. And I thought I chose that episode because this idea of flow and the importance of flow is something that really can help us understand our experience of media beyond just television, but certainly beyond contemporary television. And so I made the connection between this broadcast about the end of the world with the famous Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast, which just, I guess it was maybe last week, celebrated its 75th anniversary. Is that correct?
Yep.
So that, which is probably the most famous example of media panic, you know, really was about not the fact that this was just such a compelling drama with the accounts of Martians and, you know, invading, but the fact that the way that they constructed that production, it included these fake commercials, fake performances, as if it was just an evening's experience of radio. And it was that kind of realism of the experience of what listening to the radio was like, which would be interrupted with these news, compelling broadcasts that and accounts of the destruction that was happening in different places, that really helped inspire that the sense of realism that might help us explain why people reacted the way that they did. So there's not such a huge distinction in some ways between our contemporary experience of media and segmentation and how those segments need to flow together in order to have a consistent brand and encourage people to watch not just one show on IFC, but a variety of shows on IFC and follow them in different places and in different formats and on different platforms than there was even, you know, 75 years ago when people listened to radio in the War of the Worlds. So I would say my piece is an example of television criticism that is both historical and contemporary. And I really see in my own approach to thinking about television, history and criticism go hand in hand. When we're doing history, when we're thinking about history, we're essentially just doing criticism of the past. And when we're looking at the present and we're thinking critically, we're writing that history of our present too.
Sure. Now, go ahead.
Can I add just two quick things? First, one of the things I really love about Ethan's essay, and I look forward to teaching it, I'll be using the book in the spring, is the way in which it allowed us to sneak advertising into the book. And one of the challenges, our concept was we are looking at an individual episode of a television show is the ideal that every essay follows. And some essays use more than one episode, but they're almost all focused on a single show. Well, the show logic is a major part of television, but the advertising logic is, you know, part of that as well. And I was really concerned that we would have this massive book covering the whole gamut of television and not address advertising. So when Ethan came up with this way of incorporating the advertising and the promotion that's embedded in the episode of Onion News Network into his essay, I think that's really important and deals with an absence that would otherwise be very glaring.
Yeah, and I would add, I would add that we also have, there's another essay on Modern Family, which of course is very popular contemporary television show. But there was an essay on Modern Family, which centered on the iPad and the release of the iPad. So that essay, which is by Kevin Sandler, is another one that looks at television narrative as well as the notion of product integration and the way that commercial television works today.
And the other point I wanted to make riffing off of what Ethan said about the role of history, one of the questions that he and I really batted around a lot when we were putting together the proposal and when we were reaching out to contributors is, you know, we want to write a book that is a collection of television criticism, but it's television criticism from an academic scholarly perspective. And we really had to figure out, well, what does that mean? What's distinctive about what we're doing in this book and what we're asking our authors to do from what is published on, you know, in the New York Times or on websites like the AV Club? Journalistic criticism, I would say right now, is really thriving in the realm of television, but we wanted to offer something distinctive that we could show our students this is what a scholarly dimension adds. And I think that the role of history is one of those crucial aspects, that even though many of these essays are about contemporary programs, they all need to be historically contextualized. They all look at the present through the lens of the past and try to understand the continuities between, you know, within a genre or within an industrial formation or within an audience segment that the past of television or other media really is the foundation on, you know, that the present programming is built on.
And I thought Jeremy Butler's chapter on Mad Men really did that, just what you're talking about there, Jason, about how it incorporated the style and the historical and to the contemporary and to really, from an academic level, not necessarily just a criticism level, but an academic level, I thought he really achieved that. And it made me think a little bit of your essay when you were talking about the DVR, Ethan, you know, how that's effect on the way, you know, the incorporation of advertising and how I believe it was Dove began running ads during Mad Men that had their characters dressed up in the contemporary style of Mad Men, so that you were fast forwarding, but then you were pausing and then you were stopping because you thought, oh, it's Mad Men. Oh, it's not Mad Men. It's an ad for Dove. And it was, you know, it was almost sort of that reverse engineering that you were just, you know, just talking about.
Absolutely. There's a variety of strategies that have been employed to blur those lines and try to get our attention and, you know, for lack of a better term, trick us into watching advertising for sure. But yeah, absolutely. Jeremy's piece is another one that is really useful, and that I have taught and used in the classroom, and is about the visual style of Mad Men and thinking about the way that we see things in television, which hasn't had the same kind of attention that has been paid to film in terms of its style, visual style, is an important component of what something means. It's not just what happens, and it's also not just about set designing and creating this authentic time, but it's also telling us something, communicating something about what the show is about and how we actually see it, which is what Jeremy's piece deals with.
Yeah, and I think that the Jeremy's piece is a good example where it applies a formalist vocabulary, which in an intro to TV class, certainly my students, I try to get them to use to think about concepts like staging and, you know, editing patterns and the sort of the juxtaposition of images. And that's an important aspect of a course. What I love about Jeremy's piece is that it uses that style in order to make an argument about the show, not just to say this is what the style is,
right?
But this is how it works and why it matters.
I want to touch on – I'm fascinated by titles of books. And the title of the book is How to Watch Television. The introduction is An Owner's Manual for Television. So there's a definite correlation between the two. And you both have touched on it a bit about, you know, who is the audience for this book. And it's not just, you know, people who care about TV, or it's not just, you know, the New York Times or, you know, it's not pop culture necessarily, but it's more academic. But still, how did you come? And maybe it's not as big a deal as I'm making it out to be, but how did you come to this title? And what was the intent with it? And when people look at it and when people pick up the book, you know, in the classroom setting, you know, what are you hoping that they get out of this?
Well, it's one of those things, right? It's a joke, and yet it's not a joke. People immediately kind of get that how to watch television. Well, that's something that everyone just assumes that they know how to watch television. But here we've put together this entire book. So maybe we're suggesting that, in fact, there are a whole variety, indeed 40 different ways of watching TV. And that's kind of another way that we approach, you know, putting this book together and what the book is actually about. When people hear criticism, too often in my class, I kind of have to start from this, and we do this in the introduction as well. Criticism isn't about a thumbs up or a thumbs down on something, right? Which is kind of the idea that's filtered throughout our culture because of Siskel and Ebert and the kind of criticism that people have seen in TV before. It's about understanding something in a different way, approaching it, looking at it, watching it, in our terms, in a way that they haven't before, right? So the title, How to Watch Television, is really, I would say, you know, both something to kind of force people to step back and think differently about something that's a part of their lives that they live with and maybe haven't been critical, you know, without being encouraged to kind of step and take that distance. And then recognizing here we have all these different ways of making sense of television amongst 40 essays, 40 different shows. Actually, I think there's 41 because we have one essay that combines two different shows.
Right.
Surely there is a different way of watching television than you had known before picking up this book.
And I would just add that when Ethan first came to me with this idea, he had the title in hand, so it's his baby. And he was also quite passionate about the title. I remember as we started talking about what the book would be, and you know, when I came on as co-editor, he said, look, anything is up for grabs. We can really reconceive things as long as we have this title. And I thought that was great because I loved the title because, like Ethan says, it both makes something incredibly familiar and defamiliarizes us with it and highlights that, you know, we do – once we have an education in media studies, we watch television differently. You know, I see things when I'm watching television that I know other people who are watching aren't going to notice. And that's because education matters. And if we can convey that to our students, and I think that every one of these essays does convey it in a different way, that there's more to see than what you might expect. And highlighting that to our students, I think is exciting in the same way that, you know, you take a, you know, literature class and it opens up a book for you, or you take art history and you see a painting and you understand it, something maybe you have seen dozens of times, but, you know, you understand it in a different way, you see it differently. And that's our goal in all these essays, is to make students see differently.
And, you know, that's really interesting that you put it that way. Henry Jenkins was on the podcast a while back, and he mentioned that one of his goals as an academic is to transcend academia. Because, you know, his goal, you know, why keep all this information bottled up in this little culture when it could be benefiting so many more? So, you know, you each have used you know, some of these essays perhaps to teach your undergraduates. The undergraduates are not at the level, some of them not, at least not yet, where you are in understanding TV culture. How do you find that they were responding to the articles from here or comparable articles that you have chosen to teach to undergrads? How do they respond to this academic look at television?
Uh, positively.
It works.
I've had some really great experiences teaching the book in the classrooms. Like I said, I just did, you know, Jason's last week, and the first question was they wanted to know if he had kids. because I think they recognized that there was this authenticity sincerity to his piece and his understanding of the material that he was looking at, you know. And it's just when you say something and you talk about how important it is, you know, to transcend an academia audience, it seems so obvious, doesn't it? I mean, how absurd to talk about television and popular culture and not seek to communicate beyond an academic audience. It makes so much sense to do that. So I've found that the students absolutely appreciate being able to read and see that you can take popular culture, and in our case, television, you can take it seriously, and you can be rigorous in approaching the analysis of popular culture without needing to unnecessarily employ a language that is going to exclude people or that is off-putting. And that, unfortunately, that does happen when you try to incorporate academic writing in courses sometimes. So I have found that, they really do appreciate it and they enjoy it. And that's one of the benefits of having 40 different contributors to a book. That's one more thing I'll say about the title is that, you know, if you're going to write a book called How to Watch Television, it would be an absurd thing for one person to write that book, or even two people. It needs to be 40 different people. It needs to be 40 different ways of thinking about and writing about television. And so I would say that, you know, again, with such a wide, broad variety of different approaches that students, they may not like one, but they're going to find another that they do appreciate, that they can identify with and maybe use on their own.
And if I could just add to everything Ethan just said, when we invited people to contribute to the book, we gave them, I think, much more concrete, focused guidance on how to develop their essays than any other anthology I've been involved with. Because we said this is designed not for an audience of fellow scholars, but for smart, engaged readers with no expertise. That can be an undergraduate class, but we also want to make sure that this book, and I think it could work really well, if you're a TV fan and you're just interested in TV, all of these essays are accessible. They're not assumed. They don't have to be taught within the context of a class. You can just pick them up, read them, and learn something, and hopefully enjoy reading them. We made it very clear to our writers that the goal of each essay is not to advance a theoretical argument. And I think that most, you know, journal articles that scholars write, the goal of analyzing something is not necessarily to understand it better, but to understand something broader. You know, these essays are shorter than a journal article, and they are designed not to advance theoretical or a, you know, conceptual argument, but rather to provide greater insight into a text. We made it very clear and did a lot of hands-on editing to ensure that the phrasing and the prose style was accessible and replicable. Hard to say, but by potential students, so that they could read an essay and say, you know, I want to write like that. I want to explore a television show like that person does. And we also made a very firm rule that citations were not. We were going to try to avoid citations of theory and of academic discourse as much as possible. So there are only a few essays that really explore a theoretical concept. And when they do, it's phrased and couched in a way that you don't need to know anything about the theory in order to understand the argument.
Did any of the contributors, and I don't need names, but did any of the contributors struggle with that? That's counterintuitive to what they've been trained to do.
Well, this is one of the advantages of having two editors is that you get good cop, bad cop. And you can enforce those guidelines, and you can get your what it is you're working on effectively through two people, maybe sometimes better than just one. But yeah, I mean, I think some struggled more than others, but they recognized what the project was about and what its utility would be. And I know that, you know, many of them recognize that they want to turn around and use this book in their own courses. So they understood what it was, what we were trying to do.
We were very selective in inviting people. We wanted to make sure that they were people not only who had good ideas and were good researchers, but we wanted people whose writing was clear, who it would not be difficult for them to write for a general audience. You know, I think that a lot of academia rewards people whose writing is very sophisticated and potentially obscure. And I think there can be a place for that, but not in this book. So we chose people who we thought were already conversant in that vein. And some of that were, you know, senior scholars. I mean, Henry Jenkins is a great example of someone who has written for a popular audience and has really had crossover appeal in great ways. Another really excellent example is Susan Douglas, who we invited to write about. And we really, I think we gave her free reign to write whatever she wanted. And she said she would love to write about Jersey Shore, which was the perfect match. You know, and so here are people who have had success writing books and articles or blogs that cross over. And that was the sort of feeling we wanted to capture. There were other people who hadn't had experience doing that who we worked with. And I think what came out in every instance was really successful. Another important thing that we had going in is that we didn't want it. We wanted the lineup of contributors to be very strong, and because we knew one of the ways in which this book would disseminate and circulate is having sort of top names in the field represented. But we also wanted to have, you know, people who were new to the field, you know, grad students or, you know, brand new assistant professors, who could contribute. And I think that certainly in my experience, being able to contribute to an anthology early in your career, when you're in a table of contents with some really heavy hitters, is a great way to sort of continue the field and sustain it. So I'm really proud of the lineup we have, that it's really a range of rank and background. And it is very, I will say, it is primarily focused on American television. And this is one of the challenges that I think television scholarship has over film studies, for instance. Film studies is pretty easy to teach international film. It's much more difficult to teach international television because the whole regulatory and economic system is so different in other places. And we just don't, you know, in the U.S., and both Ethan and I are, you know, American, and I think that there's just not that exposure and circulation of international television as there is compared to film. So we made the conscious decision to prioritize American television, with a couple of examples of British imports and crossovers.
Okay, so the book is out and it's available for instructors to use in their classroom. What is, now that this is done, what is next on each of your agendas?
Wow. To keep teaching a variety of classes and doing research in television, as well as I'm currently editing a documentary that I'm making about a television show, a one-off program that was made in 1960 about a family, a real-life family in Amarillo, Texas, that is a kind of a precursor, I think, to the family reality television shows that exist today. So I'm working on that documentary. I'm also doing research in television of the 1960s and the ways in which comedy in the 60s could or couldn't incorporate satire, what the kind of limits were of controversial content in 60s television comedy.
And I just finished writing another monograph called Complex Television, which is forthcoming from NYU Press. It's also available online. I did an open access peer review of the pre-publication draft. So that has been sort of my big research project for many years now, and it's now to a point that it's almost done. So once that's put to bed, the next thing I'm going to be focused on is I wrote a textbook a number of years ago called Television and American Culture, which was published by Oxford in 2009. And it's time to revise it. It's somewhat dated in terms of some of its examples, and certainly in terms of the distribution mechanisms and technologies that we use to engage with television. That's such a moving target that I feel like it has to be updated. So as soon as I get a little breathing room and do some research, updating the textbook is my next big project.
Well, good luck with all your projects. This one is How to Watch Television, edited by Ethan Thompson and Jason Mattel. And guys, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
You've been listening to New Books in Journalism, part of the New Books Network. You can find How to Watch Television, edited by Ethan Thompson and Jason Mattel, at Amazon and other retailers. Thanks for listening.